Welcome back to the American Israelite Newspaper Podcast, the Let There Be Light Podcast, and I am one of your co-hosts, Netanel Ted Deutsch, and I'm here with my other co-host, Julie.
Julie Bernson-Brook, and today is Friday, September 10th, 2021, and it is the 4th of Tishrei, and we are in a new year, 5782, so Shana Tova, Happy New Year to you and to everyone who listens to us. And our front cover is just beginning the celebrations that we're going to have. Is it like 16 or 18 months of celebration?
18. Well, you should say why we're here on Friday.
Well, we're here on Friday because of Rosh Hashanah.
Well, we normally do a show on Wednesday. Wednesday was day two.
And then Thursday was some Gedalia, which we will hopefully get an education. Fast of Gedalia. And we will hopefully have an education lesson on that soon enough. But in the meantime, we are getting ready for some of the biggest celebrations in Cincinnati's Jewish community since its founding in around 1821 when it established its first cemetery.
All right, so we also have to say that the first Jewish person that came to Cincinnati was Jonah Jonas.
Right.
Joseph. And that was in 1817. And then 4 years later, they established the cemetery. So we're basing the bicentennial on the cemetery.
Right. And the cemetery itself is the first thing that was made. I believe probably a mikveh was made quite either at that same moment or around that same time. Because usually there's two theories that are going on, is that the first thing you build is a mikveh, the other is a cemetery. So I guess it just depends on what's going on in the community at that time. But this front cover shows the press release that was on September 2nd. And you were there. So tell us a little bit about the press release. Where was it at?
Okay,
and what did you see?
So the last time I was at the Chestnut Streets, it was several years ago for like a Jewish tour of Cincinnati. And so I hadn't been there for a while. And it's been a couple years. And it was, you know, just the cemetery, but it was somewhat in, you know, disrepair and stuff like that, I guess you'd say. And they cut the lawn and stuff like that. But when we went back for this, which was on September 2nd, Thursday. Thursday, right. So the entranceway has all been redone. It's all been with paver stones, and it's got a Mogen David in the thing. And then it's all been cleaned up. All the headstones have been cleaned. And that's why I took a couple pictures of some of the headstones. You can actually read them. That they had become like moss, you know, get the moss
cover
on there.
Right.
And so there was a perimeter about it. There was like some trees and stuff that had built, you know, like honeysuckle trees. And that's all been cleared out. The whole thing is cleared out and cleaned up. And then the original wall has been tuck pointed. And then if you see in the middle, they've fixed all that with, you know, new concrete and stuff like that and fixed all that. And then they're fixing the wrought iron. That's all being rebuilt. And then you're going to have a 4-foot fence around it and then an 8-foot fence, too, in the outside. And it's been kept. I mean, one of the things that came out of the press conferences, this is an active neighborhood. I don't know if you've ever been down there. It's like behind Channel 48. It's like back in there. And there's people that actively live there. It's kind of like it's a neighbor. I never realized that until I'd parked my car and I'm walking up to Chestnut Street. There's like houses and, you know, row houses, and they're well kept, brand new door, you know, brand new. People live there. I never thought about that. So the other thing that kind of strikes you is where you're at in Chestnut Street. So you're like near Channel 48. At that time, the population and the buildings were all like downtown along the river. It started, you know, Cincinnati started along the river and then grew outward from, you know, up, you know, what's that, 2nd Street, 3rd Street, 4th Street, 5th Street, 6th Street. You're at like maybe like 16th, 17th Street, you know, if you kind of those, you know, it's like, you know, Court Street, you know. So that they put it kind of like on the boundary of where the people were living at the time.
Right, they always put those on the edges of the city.
Yeah.
But, you know, this whole celebration begins on the 25th and Saturday night on the 25th.
Right,
after sundown,
right.
They will be respecting all people.
Yep.
And it's going to begin with a concert.
Yep.
The headliner being Matisyahu,
yeah.
who is a top 40 American musician. And it's going to go on for that evening. And then the next day, there's going to be, everyone's going to meet at the cemetery, and then they're going to march over to a park, and they're going to have a big celebration of the park in
Washington Park. That's the Ish Festival is going to be happening there, too.
Correct. And next week, in your Israelite, you're going to get an amazing fold-out color brochure of what's going on for the entire 16, 18 months of the Cincinnati Bicentennial. It's amazing. Yeah. It's beautiful. It's got all the people that are sponsoring it. The American Israelites, one of the sponsors, of course, Ish, the JCRC, Kroger, PNC. It's amazing, and it's been beautifully done. And, of course, we've talked about the pomegranate. I'm sorry, the pomegranate shape. Okay, and then on the top corner is that wonderful Hamsa that says Jewish Cincinnati Bicentennial. So there is the pomegranate on the top, and it's got the Hamsa and the lines that represent, you know,
the river. Right.
And, you know, it's just beautiful in all the different colors.
It's
just really, really beautiful. The artwork is amazing, and, of course, it was created in-house at the Jewish Federation. Of Cincinnati, they did a beautiful job, and everyone's going to get that next week. But one of the things I thought that was most beautiful about this front article was a quote from David Harris, where he said, "The JCRC sacred trust to honor our dearly departed and maintain their final resting places, and the responsibility and privilege of preserving and sharing the collective history of our community that is enshrined in the cemetery." Mm-hmm. And I thought that's just a beautiful quote about what was going on.
Well, I call him Mr. Common Sense.
Yes, you do call
yes,
him.
Yes, I do. And he's now taken that up as his new name. So we were down there, and I went up to him, and I said, "How you doing, Mr. Common Sense?" And he's like, "Well," he was explaining to me the wall, and this and they've repaired this and repaired that. He went through the whole thing of what they've been repairing, and now he's taken up the fact that he's wearing it with pride that he's now Mr. Common Sense. And he's telling everybody that that's his new name.
Yes, what a nice guy, and he is really helping our community in the position he has. Really nice.
Yeah, he's a good guy. You're
so anyway, on page four, the American Israelite Community Calendar is there, and it lists all the different synagogues, what times are all the Kol Nidre and the Yisker services and everything that you need to know. Now, you said you went to services at Gulf Manor.
Yeah.
And I listened to our own synagogue, Adith Israel, watched that on Zoom, and then I also, actually it was Adith Israel Live I watched it with, and then on the drive home, we watched Park Avenue. Well, I watched it. Barry listened to Park Avenue Synagogue. So I had quite a good experience not being able to go into a synagogue.
All right, so Wednesday night, which is the 15th, and then is Kol Nidre. And the 14th, which is Thursday, is Yom Kippur. And then Nila service ends the services. Nila is the gates. The gates are closing. So that's when the sundown is happening. And then the final shofar blowing is then, too. And then that's the end. And then Sukkot starts.
And Sukkot.
So everybody's got to get their sukkah up.
And what a nice year that'll be, because it's going to be warm this year. People are really going to enjoy being out in their sukkahs, you know.
Yeah, sometimes it's warm, sometimes it's cold. You just never know what sukkah's going
to be. Because of the way the calendar works. And next year's going to be popped back to later in the year.
You just never know.
On page eight, we go back to a very famous history of when Sandy Koufax refused to play on Yom Kippur. And it was on October 6, 1965. Now, I was 5 years old, so you were probably years old.
No, I would have been 58, so I would have been
7 years old. And I guess the team lost that day.
They lost. He was supposed to pitch the game, and he said, "I'm not pitching because it's Yom Kippur." And they lost that game, but he pitched like the second game and then like the last couple games.
Right, but they also lost the second game, but they end up, you told me, and it's in the article, they ended up winning the series.
They did. Here's the Dodgers. The Dodgers did win that series, 65.
On page nine, I am very upset about this article on page nine. Talks about the University of Illinois. Okay. It's at Chicago. That's where I got my MBA.
Okay.
Years ago, for anyone who is from Chicago, that's the Circle Campus, and now it is known as the University of Illinois at Chicago. Now, I went to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for my undergraduate in urban planning. But this is a tremendously disturbing article that is going on the campus. It seems to have some of the greatest anti-Semitism going on
where's it coming from?
It's coming from a group called Students for Justice in Palestine.
Okay.
And they have a leader of this group that has had a campaign that it's beyond my scope of understanding how someone can go about and have these ideas that she has about really tormenting people, both emotionally with pictures. She's saying that you should go around and make suggestions of comments that Zionists have no culture and that they should go back to Brooklyn. Mm. Now, these are unbelievable comments. I am not only disappointed that this is going on in my former university.
Well, your hometown.
My hometown. Right. It's going outside of the campus. It's going right into the Jewish community there. You know, I usually like to avoid these unhappy articles. We have so many of them, and right, I like to avoid them. But because this is something, this is also where my daughter Melissa did her residency and her fellowship was at University of Illinois at Chicago. And at no time did I ever think that I would ever be saying that some campus that I went to is participating at this level of anti-Semitism. And it's just very devastating
to me.
Well,
there's how many Jews live in Chicago?
I couldn't tell you.
Like almost probably several, maybe 100,000. Maybe
a lot.
Okay. So they must be doing things to deal with this.
They have a very strong Jewish Federation of Metropolitan Chicago. They have a very strong Jewish Federation, and it's called Jewish United Fund there, and they have, I'm sure they have all the organizations that we have, and there's people of prime. I mean, let's not forget Ron Emanuel is Jewish, and he was the former mayor, and Jews have been involved. I've never in my life remembered ever really being afraid or that Chicago was anti-Semitic. Well, you remember during the 70s now in Skokie, Illinois, which is a suburb that is very, very Jewish and right now very Orthodox Jewish, they Nazis marched. Now, I distinctly remember that.
Right, right.
But at no time in my life growing up did I ever feel anti-Semitism.
So would you say this is an isolated incident, or is it?
I understand this going on a lot of campuses, but it's disturbing and personally offensive to me that this is my university.
Okay, so the other thought I'm having would be, what if this happened in Cincinnati, and what would our response be if it happened at UC?
Well, we have a very strong Hillel here. We also have a very strong JCRC. And I know that the community of Cincinnati, also like the community of Chicago, probably would not put up with this and would work against it. That I know, I don't even have to have that as my hope, I know. And I am sure in Chicago that anyone who is aware of what's going on, Jew or non-Jew, is working to stop this.
The other thing is, you know, once we give them publicity, it kind of encourages them to do more, to get more publicity, so you know, it becomes a question for a publisher and us, you know, as podcasters, should we cover this? And should we give them the publicity of negative publicity that they're seeking?
Well, in politics, the thing is, any publicity is good publicity.
Okay.
Getting your name out there, because people may not remember the story, but they remember your name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So maybe that's why they're doing it also.
Correct.
Yeah.
And on to more sad news. Of course, Ida scattered a lot of Jews in New Orleans as they were preparing for the high holidays. Another problem. Unfortunately, the paper is filled with a lot of anti-Semitism. And
there's stuff that we have, you know.
We have to let people know that these things are going on so that they are aware.
Yeah. It's good and bad. It's balance. You have to have balance. All right.
One of the interesting stories on page 12 under international is that a 700-year-old prayer book is going up for auction for $4 million.
Well, they think it could go for $4 million. You don't, until you get into the auction, and you don't really know what it's going to go for. But it's a Luzzatto, Luzzatto, High Holiday Moxor. And so a Moxor is the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur book all in one.
Okay.
And so I have a Moxor for Rosh Hashanah. I use a transliterated, and then I have a transliterated Yom Kippur Moxor that's now in my Stender at Golf Manor currently. And then when I'm done, I'll take it home. But
and this comes from Southern Germany in the late 13th and early 14th century. That would be really very, very cool to get to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure been taken care of and kept in the proper environment.
You know what's beautiful about this new paper is you can see
the colors.
Yeah, the color, and you can see the Hebrew writing. So it could go for between $4 and $6 million.
On page 13, there's two articles that are good articles. One, first, an Israeli first doctor separated twins conjoined at the skull. So they had separate brains, but their skulls were connected, and they have successfully separated them. And that's great news and always good. Israel's medical community is amazing. And then secondly, birth trade trips are to resume without quarantines for vaccinated. So that's wonderful, too.
And it took, well, it's what's interesting is it took, for the twins, it took 12 hours.
Those are very long surgeries.
Long
and
surgeries.
And they have shifts of doctors that come in and out.
Do that. 12 hours of those kids being in there in surgery.
And our coloring contest runners-up and winners continue in the next few pages. And, you know, Yossi Davis's two children are represented here. They're both very beautiful picture. His daughter, Sarah, age 11, did the one on page 17 in the top corner. And his son, Yossi, did YY's son.
Yes,
Yossi Davis is his son that's age 9.
Yeah.
He's got beautiful children.
Yes, he does.
Now, I'd like
they're
you
like,
to
like
read.
Mini-me's.
Yeah.
They are like mini-me's, yeah. Don't they? They look just like him. They're just like mini ones.
Cute kids. I'd like you to read the correction, please.
Oh, the correction. Okay. So my correction is, in my yearly State of the City editorial, which is from September 2nd, I was remiss in not thanking the most important person in my life, my lovely and talented wife, Stephanie. And it's because of her that I have wind in my sails, and she inspires me every single day. And may she have a great year and an inspired and fruitful year this new year, and I love you.
That's really beautiful. That Aww. Really touches my heart.
So
very
she
beautiful.
Would tell you I have wind, but it's not in the sails.
I think that's all men.
Is it? Is it? We're all just full of hot air, one way or another.
So, Ted, we've got this great interview today with retired FBI agent David Lichtenfeld.
Okay.
We have a lot to learn about him. You know, we also had read about him a couple of months ago in our sports column.
Okay.
And we learned that he was a big football player. This is something I guess he doesn't talk about now. But we're going to have David on our phone, retired agent David Lichtenfeld. You ready?
Welcome to the show.
Welcome, David. Say hello.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So Ted's very excited. He's got a couple of questions on his own that I didn't know about, but we're very, very excited to find out a little bit more about you. So tell us, you know, where did you grow up and how did you get to our sports column in the first place?
Well, I was born in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, and I grew up basically in an area called Drexel Hill, Pennsylvania, and that's where I went to high school in Upper Darby. I was fortunate in playing football that I did well and made the all Delaware County football team my senior year. And then I got a scholarship to college, a couple of colleges, but I selected Gettysburg College because it was only a couple of hours from where I was living at the time. And I had a football scholarship to Gettysburg. So I ended up spending 4 years playing football at Gettysburg.
And you're in the Hall of Fame for your school, correct?
For my high school.
So what position did you play?
I was a running back, halfback, halfback.
Okay.
Yeah. And I will tell you this. I have an article. It was in the local paper, one of the games at my high school, and there was a little paragraph where they talked about two of the running backs were consistently making gains, and they said, and despite his fractured wrist, David Lichtenfeld was named Crazy Legs by the newsmen covering the game. I thought that was funny. So that Crazy Legs stayed with me all through college, too.
Did you use those Crazy Legs when you were an FBI agent?
No, they didn't call me Crazy Legs as an FBI agent.
Did you have a code name?
No, I never, in the FBI, no, never had a code name.
Never had a code.
I just used my own name with every investigation that I did.
So let's go into your background just for a little bit. So you grew up in this Derby, and did you have a bar mitzvah? And can you remember anything about your bar mitzvah?
Well, you know, it's funny growing up. I don't remember whether our family, I have a brother and a sister, both younger than me, and I don't remember if we were going to the synagogue on a regular basis or not. I just don't remember it so many years back. But I do remember that, yes, I did have a bar mitzvah when I was 13, and in a synagogue. And I do remember that. And I do remember that I memorized my Torah portion. The rabbi then put it on, recorded it on a disc for me, and a record. And I played that over and over and memorized my Torah portion.
Wonderful. Yeah.
No, I just say I had a full bar mitzvah, yeah, and then a party afterwards.
That sounds wonderful. That sounds wonderful. And then you went on, you played football, you went to college. So how did you become the FBI agent that you are?
Well, I'll tell you, it's very interesting. When I was growing up, I never had any idea of anything I wanted to do. I know that sounds crazy, but I did not. My father was an attorney, and he had his own office. My mother worked as in a courthouse. She was a deputy registrar in a courthouse. And I just never didn't know what I wanted to do. And when I knew that when I graduated high school, that college was the next thing that we did at that time. So I continued on to play football and go to college. And even when I was in college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And when I graduated college, I never went out and took any interviews for jobs. So what I ended up doing was, I said, I'm going to serve my country. And so I joined in the Army. And I spent 2 years in the Army in Germany. And then when I got out, I got a job, to work. I was working in a department store downtown Philadelphia. I was hired because a neighbor who happened to be Jewish, he either owned the department store or was the chief executive officer, but he gave me a job working in one of the departments in the store. And then I wanted to get something better as time went on, and I got a job then working for State Farm Insurance Company as a claims adjuster. And at that time, I had gotten married for the first time, and I had my first child, a daughter. And I started thinking while I was working at State Farm, I want to get something better now that I have a wife and a child. And one day in the State Farm office, I was talking to a secretary, and she mentioned in our conversation that her father was an FBI agent. And I said, oh, well, what's that? And she got me information from her dad. I looked at it, and I thought, wow, I can serve my country again. So I applied, and that's how I got into the FBI. It was nothing that I was thinking I wanted to do. It was just that conversation made me think, here's another job. I can be serving my country, and I can be doing something that I felt was, you know, a good work to do. And you know how I got the offer to become an agent? Back then in 1965, July the 14th, I got a telegram offering me the position of special agent with the FBI, starting salary $7,900 a year. I had to agree to work for 3 years, I was to report on July the 26th to training in Washington, D.C. But the telegram was sent to me and signed by J. Edgar Hoover,
wow,
the director of the FBI for almost 48 years.
Did you save that?
Yeah,
always?
Did you save that? Yeah, did you frame that?
I have it right now with me. And yes, I'm going to get it framed. Mm-hmm. I just think it's fantastic that it was a telegram. You all remember the telegram. Strips of paper with the words printed on them,
You
know, glued onto the telegram. Oh my gosh, it's unbelievable. And I still have that. Yes, I am going to get it framed.
Well, that's history. That's definitely history.
Oh, absolutely. And I met Mr. Hoover. When I came in, he wanted to meet every new agent. So when we were finishing up training, we got to meet him at his office. And I will tell you this, I was told by our counselor there were 26 of us in my new agent's class, and we were told to make sure our suit was clean and pressed. And Mr. Hoover likes a firm handshake, but he does not like a sweaty palm. So all of us are in this room waiting to be, you know, introduced to him, and we're rubbing our hands on our pants and shaking hands with each other. You know, how's that feel? Is that firm? Is he dry? Hell yeah. And so we got a chance to be able to shake hands with him, thank him for the opportunity to serve the Bureau in the United States. And that was the meeting with Hoover. Yeah.
So we can't go into specifics of exact stuff, but can you give us any funny stories or funny cases that you had during your tenure in the FBI?
Well, I'll tell you, I worked, you know, over 27 years as an agent. So I worked many criminal cases is what I worked. Bank robberies, kidnapping, extortions, interstate transportation of stolen property, theft from interstate shipment, and looking for fugitives. And I had, you know, a lot of cases. I can't remember all of them now time, but I did have a situation that I'll tell you quickly here. I had a fugitive assigned to me who was a deserter from the Army, the military, and the FBI would get those, and he would become a fugitive. And I had an address of where he was supposed to be living. I went to that address, knocked on the door. This man, young man, answered the door, and I said, I'm looking for, we'll say, John Doe. And he said, no, that's not me. I said, who are you? He said, I'm his brother. So I said, well, tell your brother to turn himself back into the military and get himself squared away. And I left. One week later, I went back to that address, knocked on the door. A little young girl answered the door. I said, I'm looking for John Doe. Nobody's here. I saw a man's hat, sitting on a table in the kitchen where the door was open. And I said, well, I'm coming in to take a look. So I walked down the hall, looked in the bedroom. There was a double bunk bed. Up in the top bunk, there was a man sleeping with his back to me on the bunk. And I just said, hey, John, let's go. I gave you an extra week. And it was him.
Wow. So the man that originally opened the door was really him,
It was the man that originally opened the door.
Wow.
And so he said, can I put on some clothes? I said, sure. So he went and he went into the closet. And, of course, I'm not sure how he's coming out. So I did pull my gun out just in case he came out with a gun.
Yeah.
But he didn't. He came out with clothes on. And I walked him to the car, put him into the driver of the passenger seat of my car, drove. I did take my gun out of my right side where I kept my gun on my right hip, put it over in my left pocket of my suit jacket. And drove downtown, turned him over to the United States Marshals, and that was it. But the funny thing is about that, in training school, we were taught when you make an arrest, use the 5S plan. The 5S's were superiority in manpower, superiority in firepower, simplicity of plan, speed in which you executed, and surprise. With those 5S's, we were told, nobody should get hurt. And I laughed at myself later on. Here I went and did and just violated all the S's we were taught in training school.
Right.
But it turned out okay.
Yeah.
It turned out okay.
Well, all the training in the world, when you get into those real-life situations, it's kind of that it always changes from what you've been trained and taught to, like,
oh, absolutely,
you know, what actually is going to happen.
Yeah. So. And I'll tell you, I'll just real quickly, a week later, I had another fugitive that was assigned to me, and he was wanted for a bank robbery out in Oklahoma. And we had an address for where he was in Ohio, in the Cincinnati area. And I went to it, and again, knocked on the door. This guy came to the door, wanted John Doe here. He said, no, it's not me. Who are you? I'm his brother. I said, tell him to turn himself in. You know, I left. I left there, and I went directly to the chief of police of that community. I just don't remember now that community where it was. But he came with me, and we went back. I knocked on the door again, and I went in, and I said, I'm taking you in. He had a tattoo that I knew he had. I told him to take off his shirt, and he had that tattoo, so I knew I had the right guy.
Yeah.
And so
it wasn't like there was Facebook to go look him up.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So how did you end up in Cincinnati?
When I first came in, right out of training school, the first 2 years I spent in North Carolina, Charlotte was the first office I went to. After a number of months there, I don't remember how many, they transferred me then to Greensboro, Pennsylvania, to Greensboro, North Carolina. And I spent the rest of 2 years. So I was in North Carolina for 2 years, and then I got transferred to Cincinnati. I came here in January 1967. I mean, it had nothing to do with me asking to go anywhere. You just go where the Hoover, Director Hoover, sends you.
Right.
And so it was here to Cincinnati. I came here in January 1967, and I remained here my entire career until I was mandatorily retired in December the 1st of 1992, when I turned 57 years old.
Oh, wow.
Now, I turned down a promotion three times while I was here in Cincinnati. And the reason I turned down promotion was it meant going to Washington, D.C. And I had gotten divorced from my first wife, and I had three young children. And I didn't want to leave and have them here in Cincinnati and me in Washington, D.C. And the third time I was given an offer of a new position with the FBI, it was a brand new job the FBI started. It was called National Applicant Recruiter. I had done applicant recruiting here in Cincinnati, and I was successful in getting, they wanted women and minorities to come into the FBI, and I was successful in doing that. So they offered me this job, National Applicant Recruiter, and I said, can I do it from Cincinnati? And they said, no, you have to come to Washington, but you'll be traveling all over the country. You can stop in Cincinnati. And I thought, what am I going to do, spend 8-10 hours in Cincinnati? So I turned that down, too. So that's how I ended up staying here in Cincinnati. And I'm glad I did. Cincinnati is a wonderful town.
Yep.
And, it's got a lot of great things to do here.
And I understand you also volunteer to read to the blind, and you do some work at Jewish Hospital when it's not COVID. Is that correct?
Yes. I volunteered for Jewish Hospital. I go there. Well, of course, it's all on hold now with the virus situation. But I was doing 3 days a week at Jewish Hospital, and I was reading for a woman here. I've been reading for a woman for 28 years. She's a writer. Her name is Deborah Kendrick, and she wrote for the Cincinnati Enquirer an article called Alive and Well, and she's written 3 books also. But, I started reading for her in March 1993, and I've been reading for her ever since, and I have another blind man that I'm reading for now for a year or so. But I also have volunteered for probably now 12 years with the Holocaust exhibit have in Cincinnati.
Okay.
That's wonderful.
I started with them when they were down right next to Heber Union College. And, of course, now they're down at Union Terminal.
Right.
I have not done any tours since they moved to the Union Terminal.
Yeah.
Well,
but, I volunteer every Saturday. I go down to the police museum in Cincinnati. So I stay busy doing volunteer work. I think it's important to do what you can to help in some way, other activities or other people. Yeah.
Well, you've done a lot for our community, and we can't thank you enough, not only for your time today as an interviewee, but also for all that you've done for the community and serving your country, and we really appreciate it. And thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for even being interested in talking to me. I appreciate that.
Well, we will be in touch again, and we really thank you, and it's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks to both of you, and have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
And stay safe.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was super interesting. He's got a lot to say and stuff he hadn't even told me when I talked to him on the phone. He's done a lot for us and our country.
Well, and he got to meet J. Edgar Hoover, and he was buddies with Johnny Bench. That's just fascinating stuff.
Well, we were lucky to have him. We really appreciate the interview we had with David, retired agent David.
Yeah, that was a great interview. And now back to our regular podcast.
Yes.
Okay.
And we're on page 20.
Yes,
and from
we are.
The pages.
Yes, we are.
And we will begin with, in the beginning, 1854.
The Israelitish Institutions of Cincinnati by Samuel Brule Eretz Yisrael continued. Its object is to collect funds annually from those who are willing to assist our poor brethren, residents in the Holy Land, and to forward the amount collected with the Matzit Heshek. I don't know what that is.
Half shekel.
Yeah, little half a shekel money. So I guess they're collecting money in Cincinnati to send to Israel.
Yes.
This is back. That's like 168 years.
Well, if you remember when we talked about the Manischewitzes, they sent one of their children to Israel to study, two young boys. So Israel was active, and it was, of course, we know it was active, but I mean, there were people going there and Jews were supporting it back then.
Yeah. Huh. Fascinating. I like this one from 150 years ago. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
A cook wanted. I wish to hire immediately a competent cook, one that can come well recommended. None other need apply. L.J. Workham, number 352 West 4th Street, September 15th, 1871.
And Workham is a name that's still here. They work at the Workham Fellowship. So yeah,
exactly.
Still a name. So
you want to do the 125 years?
Yes. Ladies column. Puffed potatoes are prepared as follows. Cut potatoes as for French fries. Put them in warm but not hot fat. Cook 10 minutes and take out and drip. Now heat the fat very hot and fry the potatoes quickly. They will puff out very much.
All right, so here's another one from 125. Last Sunday night, Mr. and Mrs. Samuel B. Goldberg celebrated their wooden wedding anniversary at their home on West 9th Street. They had issued very novel invitation on pieces of pine the size of a postal card. There were over 100 guest presents. The souvenirs of the occasion were miniature Japanese houses of cedar and bamboo, and on the roof is done in exquisite pen work, Mr. and Mrs. Samuel B. Goldberg, at home Tuesday, September 22nd at 8 o'clock. Editor's note, the wood anniversary is the 5th.
Wow.
So we're coming up, Stephanie and I are coming up on number 5, which will be Thanksgiving.
And my son was born on September 22nd, my Daniel.
All right, so you want to do the next one?
There is a beautiful exhibit of paintings on China in Hershey's window on 4th Street. The work of Miss Sadie, I'm assuming that's Schwartz, a talented pupil of the Cincinnati Art School. Among the pieces are 8 cups and saucers of exquisite design, which were ordered by Sir Moses Ezekiel for parties in Rome and in England. Huh. The well-known sculptor is enthusiastic in his criticisms of the young painter's skill and predicts a brilliant future for her. The work will be on exhibition for several days and is well worth a visit. Must be beautiful. I wish we could get a picture of that.
Yeah. All right. So
100 years ago, you liked the For Rent.
Yes, I like this one. For Rent, 2 seats at the Rockdale Avenue Temple, pew 120, telephone Avon 2654, September 15th, 1921.
And there's a lot of weddings and bar mitzvahs of which you knew some of the people in 50 years ago.
So Mr. and Mrs. So this is 50 years ago. Mr. and Mrs. John Rosenthal cordially invite their friends and relatives to worship with them at the bas mitzvah of their daughter, Heidi, Friday, September 10 at 8:15 p.m. at Temple Sholom, 3100 Longmeadow Lane, followed by an Oneg Shabbat. Now that means there's going to be some food.
Yes.
And I knew Heidi from Ohio U.
Okay.
She was in my class, and she hung out at the A.E. Pie House. She was like a friend, a buddy.
So. And we have, on 25 years ago, Scott and Natalie Rothschild-Wolf.
I want to do another one.
Okay, you do another one, and then we'll go back.
Mr. and Mrs. Eric Hattenbach of 2417 Kellerman Avenue take great pleasure announcing the forthcoming bar mitzvah of their son, Mark Hattenbach, on Saturday, September 11 at 9 a.m. at Adith Israel Synagogue.
Very cool.
And Mark Hattenbach also went to Ohio U.
And where is he?
These are both OU people.
And where is Mark Hattenbach now?
I think he's in L.A.
So back to 25 years ago, Scott and Natalie Rothschild-Wolf,
and
she is a city councilwoman from Amberley Village,
announced
the birth of a daughter, Sarah Mallory, August 22nd. Sarah has 2 brothers, Freddie and Adam.
Oh, so shout out to everybody that we were talking about today. All right. So, Jews in the News. It's interesting. There's some more stuff about Edna Asner. He was really very Jewish and very well known.
Yeah. Now, Sugar and Spice is our dining out, and it talks about how they crack up to 450 eggs or so each day.
That is
not tremendous. Only that, but they go through 4 gallons of batter for their really thin, thin pancakes. That's an amazing amount of food to go through.
It is.
And, you know, they have 2 locations now, one in their original on Reading Road, and then there's one downtown.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I think it's the old the Sycamore Diner.
Yes, it is.
That's the Sycamore Diner.
And, of course, Gail Schindler has a bunch of great-looking recipes. This is the Ruth Levine's. That's her mother's plum tart. Mm-hmm. And it looks great. It gives all the instructions on how to make the plum tart, and it serves 6 to 12. Mm. And she goes and talks about the harvest festivals.
That
I remember last
year.
Yummy
to me.
Yeah,
it does. I'm kind of hungry right now, even though I just ate.
And on the advice of Dr. Ruth Nemzoff, it actually strikes a chord with me.
Okay.
The writer is writing in at grandparents' day at her grandson's Jewish day school. The principal suggested that the grandchildren and grandparents have a common enemy, the parents. And the article goes on to say it's about when children go to the grandparents' house and the grandparents don't follow the rules.
Uh-huh.
And she goes on, and this person is upset by that because she feels that, you know, is this really something funny? And first, Ruth Nemzoff goes off and talks about, well, really, you know, what's funny, what's not funny, depending on your situation. And she talks about that. And then she goes on to say that, you know, parents have to make a decision. Do you want to think of your children when they go to their grandparents? It's like a little mini vacation for your children.
Right, right.
Or do you expect them to have the same regime you have in your own house? And what happens is they go to the grandparents and, you know, all bets are off, you know. In my family, they get the Pop-Tarts, get the chocolate milk, you stay up late at night, sort of a thing.
It is kind of like a vacation.
It's a vacation.
It's like, yeah, because, yeah.
And then the complaint was, well, the kids come home whiny and the parents get upset because all the rules have been broken. It takes them a while to swing back into the regime. But the proposal from Ruth and another advisor is, why don't you think of it as a mini vacation? Just like when you go on vacation, you change your sleep routines, you change your eating, and things are special.
Right.
And I remember when I was a kid, my dad would say, well, we're on vacation now. You know, you get to do this, you get to do that. So I think that was a good way to take care of it. But, you know.
It's common sense.
Yeah.
And if you look at it kind of in a different way, it kind of makes sense to you how to do it.
Parents shouldn't be upset. They should be lucky that they have their parents to take care of their children or to spend special time taking
care. You're just saying that because, you know, you're putting in a plug for yourself as the
correct.
Grand. Yeah, of course.
Soft and juicy. On 26, there was an interesting obituary about Larry Harlow,
yeah.
The El Judio Marveloso. So it ends up, he was neither a Latino, nor did he have Latin American roots, but he had, at one point in his life, gone to Cuba. And he took a one-way trip to Cuba, rented a bus, or bought a bus, and went around Cuba to immerse himself in the Cuban culture of music. Hmm. And he became an incredible musician with a Latin background. So it's very interesting, yeah.
All right, so death notices. Leonor Krinick, knee hotis, age 96, September 2nd, 2021, 26, Elul, 5781.
Samuel Nadel, Dr. Samuel Nadel,
yep.
Age 99, September 2nd, 2021, the 25th of Elul, 5781.
Marianne Pressman, knee, Kaitler?
Yeah.
Kaitler,
yeah.
Age 84, September 1, 2021, 24, Elul, 5781.
And Bella, nee Benzilio Uziel, age 96. And she is the mother-in-law of the teacher from Yavna, Mrs. Uziel. September 1st, 2021, 24 of Elul, 5781. Okay. May all their memories be for a blessing.
Right. So we're kind of doing a short show today.
And it's going to be delayed. So it's going to be delayed when it goes out to when it's posted because our Melissa House,
right.
Who is so wonderful for us,
right.
Is on a well needed and well deserved vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Now time for bad joke of the week.
Wait a minute, bad joke of the week time? Hold on. How about this one? That's a good one. That's good. Okay. So this is from the Big Book of Jewish Humor, 25th anniversary, edited and annotated by William Novak and Moshe Waldox. Gottlieb, an avid baseball fan, calls his rabbi a few hours before Kol Nidre. "Rabbi, what am I going to do? It's the playoffs tonight, and I can't miss the Red Sox-Yankees game." "What's the problem?" says the rabbi. "Don't you have a DVR?" "I didn't think of that. You mean I can record Kol Nidre?"
That's actually pretty good.
Okay, that's enough out of me.
We wish everyone a good week during these 10 days. Take your time. Think before you speak.
Right.
And we will see you next week.